Morning, this is Joel Miller, researcher with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and I'm joined by Steve Mintz, who is your title?
Staff writer.
A staff writer, also with the FCIC, and we have begun reporting on October 8th, 2010, about 5 minutes after 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And what the FCIC is empowered to do is determine the contributing causes of the financial crisis, and our primary mission is to draft a report for Congress that describes the conditions and the events surrounding that financial crisis. So this interview then is our effort to better understand some of the facts that contributed to the crisis and events that occurred during the crisis of 2007 and 8. Steve, anything else?
No, I think that's exactly what we want to know. We want to know anything that you guys are aware of that will help us figure out what caused the crisis.
And on your end, who's online?
All right, so I'm Karen Jacobs. I'm a lawyer at Winston & Strong. We have Nancy Brown and Jennifer Kotler, who are lawyers within Northern Trust. And then we have Michael Vardis, who will identify himself and his current title.
And just to move on, I'm Michael Vardis. I'm head of capital markets for Northern Trust Company, which has capital markets comprised of securities lending and our brokerage subsidiary, MTSI.
Okay. And just to get started in a minute or so, if you could describe your educational background and your job experiences leading up to working for Northern Trust.
Okay. I have a Bachelor of Business Administration from Emory University that I received in 1982, and I worked approximately a year for the Chicago Board Options Exchange once I graduated from there. And in August of 83, I joined Northern Trust Company in our Treasury Department, where I was responsible for managing Fed funds, our reserve position management, asset and liability management, which dealt with the portfolio management of the bank's portfolio, the risks associated with the bank's balance sheet, various hedging and capital management and liquidity management activities. I was in that role, various roles within the Treasury Department for approximately 11 years. During that time, I went to the Northwestern Graduate School of Business and received my Master of Management degree, fulfilled those requirements by December of 1986, and I think the degree was actually conferred in the spring of 1987. And also during my time in the Treasury Department, I went and sat for the Chartered Financial Analyst designation, and I believe that I received that in 1993. And So I'm interweaving some of my academic experience with my job experience. And then in 1994, I moved from the Treasury Department into our securities lending business, where I was responsible for the trading aspects of that business, which meant the lending of securities and the reinvestment of cash collateral or management of non-cash collateral. And over that period of time, I got more involved in the management, global business, management of people, took on more responsibility for product and relationship management and risk management around the globe. And then in May of 2005, I was asked to run our quantitative business here at the Northern Trust Company, quantitative investment business, that is, which was comprised of our index, our passive business, our quant active business, and our tax advantaged equity business. And the assets that we managed in that business totaled somewhere around $250 billion. And I was managing that business until really formally until the first quarter of 2009, but in the fall of 2008, when the financial crisis reached a crisis point with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, I became more actively involved in the management of securities lending, and then formally at the beginning of 2009 was when we Northern Trust Company formed Capital Markets, which is what I have responsibility for today, which is global securities lending and our business. So the head of global securities lending is in London, and he reports to me, and the head of our, the president of our brokerage business is here in Chicago, and he reports to me. And also I would just add, for just to be complete, that I was responsible for our transitions business beginning in 2004, and that's now part of our brokerage business, and that involves the buying and selling of securities for our clients when they hire and fire investment managers when they're changing investment mandates. So that is a history of my, I'm a member of the Chartered Financial Analyst Society and the Investment Analyst Society of Chicago.
Okay, thank you. A lot of expertise there, and we hope that in the next hour or so we'll be able to learn quite a bit from you. I sent a number of questions, I think on August 31st of 2010, to Nancy. Were you given an opportunity to look at those questions?
I was.
Okay. So those are sort of the core of what we're looking at here and where we hope we can gain something from the benefit of your expertise. And I guess to get us started, at Northern, it sounds like the securities lending business is part of a broader line of business. So where would it fall organizationally?
That is correct. Since Northern Trust is a custodian, in our securities lending business, we act as agent on behalf of our custody clients primarily. And historically, therefore, the securities lending business has been very closely associated with our corporate and institutional client base. From a organizational point of view, over the years, organizationally, the securities lending business has been both formally part of our corporate institutional business, and then it was part of our Northern Trust investments business, which was obviously market focused, and I believe it was part of that business from, I don't know the exact year that we became part of Northern Trust Investments, but it was around the year 2000, is my, the best of my recollection, maybe 1999. And as we move into next year, we will be realigning our business closer to our institutional business once again. But it falls essentially as part of our overall institutional business and services that we offer to our institutional clients.
Okay. And what we're trying to determine is, you know, pre-crisis, how did this sec lending business work? Did it work well? Were there problems prior to, let's say, 2006 that you were aware of?
We think that the business worked well as it was constructed, both, you know, prior to 2006 and after 2006. And I know you'll probably ask me some follow-up questions on that particular issue. So I'm hesitant to, create a differentiation in, you know, how well the business works, because the reason I'm making this point is the business, even, let's say, pre-crisis and post-crisis, worked the way that it was designed and intended to work. And, I think that and I know you mentioned 2006. You know, not sure of the relevance of that year in particular, but what I would say is that the securities lending business, over the time that I've been involved in it, and really, let's call it since 1994, and then of course there was a 3-year period that I was out of it, but I was able to, by my participation as an executive member of the Northern Trust Investments business, I was able to understand and be aware of how that business was operating really between 1994 and where we are today. And, you know, the business operated in a manner in which it was designed, meaning, you know, safeguards that were in place, the processes that were in place with regard to a number of aspects of the business, all operated as designed.
Okay. Can you walk us through who your customers are and who, I assume they're the ones with the securities, who do they typically end up lending securities to, why those borrowers of the securities need the securities, how the cash collateral works? If you could walk us through for a few minutes just how it's structured and how it's and who the parties are to these arrangements.
So are you, Joel, are you asking right now just for kind of like, you know, the flow chart, how does securities lending work as a process?
Exactly, the way Northern has it set up and how it's historically worked, and it sounds like it worked the same as a process, and correct me if I'm wrong, during the crisis as well as preceding the crisis.
I would say that's correct, yes.
So if you could just walk us through who the parties are, who are your customers, who you're doing business with, that sort of thing.
Okay. The answer is not going to be an all-inclusive answer, of course, but the types of clients that we have are ERISA funds, pension funds, for example, public funds, so police and fire, teachers, etc. We have sovereign wealth funds as clients. We have foundations and endowments. We have Taft-Hartley entities as clients. So that's a pretty good cross-section of the types of clients we have. And again, the capacity that we operate in as Northern, as lending securities on behalf of our clients, is we are agents. So we're not taking a principal position. We are connecting, we are lending our client securities to a broker dealer, a registered broker dealer. And I think that was the other part of the question that you were asking is, who do we lend these securities to? We lend them to registered broker dealers, and you know, those would be some of the names that you would be familiar with, like a Goldman Sachs, like a Morgan Stanley, for example, among others. And so when we lend those securities, because we're acting as agent, the client is lending the security to the broker dealer, and the broker dealer has therefore credit exposure to the client who has lent them their security. With regard to why do securities get lent, there are a number of reasons, and since I'm not on the side of the broker who is borrowing these securities, I can't say with, you know, specific information and knowledge, you know, why securities are being borrowed, but I do have, you know, enough knowledge with respect to the history of the business to understand, to provide an example. And you've probably heard this one before, but many times securities are lent because, for example, a broker has sold a security to a client, and they bought a security from another counterparty, and it turns out this counterparty that they purchased the security from is failing to deliver that security to them. So they want to make delivery of the security that they sold to their client, and they will come to custodians such as ourselves who hold large pools of assets on behalf of our clients and have an agented program and come to us to borrow that security to satisfy that settlement need. That's a specific example, and a more general view of the securities lending market from a, you know, out in the academic world is that the ability to borrow and lend securities provides a broader amount of liquidity and depth to the financial markets, which leads to more efficient prices in the financial market. So that's just a specific example, and then a more general rationale for why the securities lending market has existed and how it has benefited global financial markets.
Okay. Well, what's in it for your customer to lend a security? Why would they ask you as their agent to lend a security for them? What benefit do they get?
In the most simplest terms, they're going to receive some type of monetary benefit associated with lending their security. And how they, and it's going to be really up to the individual customer to determine how they, really what type of benefit they're looking to have. And what I mean by that is you have clients who, for example, may look at the securities lending program because they want to earn some incremental income to offset other costs associated with their management of their pension program. You may have some clients who look at securities lending and feel that the incremental income that they earn is enhancing the return on their overall investment portfolio. So that would be, I think if you wanted to really do a high level, that would be a couple of the very large value drivers on behalf of various clients that you could put them in those two categories, and probably there's a number of subcategories that flow from that, but those would be the two categories that I would think of. Why client benefits from securities lending.
Is there a way you can quantify for us, you know, historically, you know, if I'm running a pension plan, let's say I have $10 billion and it's, you know, getting a 5% return, I mean, how much incremental income would the pension plan receive typically in a SEC from a SEC lending program?
I'll caveat it with, you know, it's going to vary depending on what each client's portfolio securities are. So that $10 billion, depending on how that underlying portfolio is structured, if it's sovereign debt, if it's small cap stocks, that will really drive how much incremental income, because it, you know, there's a certain demand for different types of securities in the marketplace. And then depending on what that client has chosen to be there, what kind of collateral they're willing to accept. So if they are only willing to accept non-cash collateral, that will probably imply lower incremental income. If they're willing to accept cash and invest it, and depending on how they choose to invest it, what risk profile they accept, that will also impact the income. So there are a number of variables that exist with regard to the type of income that a client might expect to earn off this. But I will say that the activity of securities lending is an ancillary activity. It's an incremental type of activity, and I don't believe that there's any securities lending securities lender, the client, that's out there looking at securities lending as the driver of returns on their overall portfolio.
Okay. If it's not the driver, if it's a merely incremental income, how do they go about obtaining that incremental income? What is it that they obtain, I guess, from the borrower of the securities that enables them to obtain some additional income for their fund, pension plan?
Are you basically asking for just like the anatomy of a particular transaction, how it works?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, let me try to do that, and I'll go back to first week. One of the most important parts of determining how value gets created is the value of the security that they have in their portfolio. So is it in high demand? If it's a large cap stock, there, like an IBM, for example, there's a lot of supply of IBM out there. And so I'm going to, you know, so one of the things I want to point out is that a great deal of the value in the securities lending program for a client is derived by how badly or how much need there is, if you will, for the borrower, the broker-dealer, to borrow that security. And the more precious or scarce that security is, the more revenue will be associated with to the client coming from the borrower in order to, you know, compel the client to lend that security. Now the transaction, which I want to talk about really quickly because that's kind of the base background, is the value of the security. But the transaction looks like the borrower and or the lending agent, Northern Trust, are going to either talk to one another telephonically, over, you know, through technology links, and the borrower will express interest in typically borrowing a security. And at that point, the lending agent, Northern Trust, will then negotiate certain aspects of the transaction. And two of those important aspects would be, what kind of collateral are you going to give me? And what is the rate or fee that I would either pay to you on that collateral in the case of cash, or if you're going to give me a non-cash collateral item such as a U.S. Treasury bill or some other sovereign debt, for example, what fee are you going to pay to me for lending you my client's security? So in the case of cash collateral, let's take that example from a mechanical point of view. The borrower calls up and we negotiate a loan of a security, and for just sake of argument, we'll say IBM, and we negotiate that based on current overnight, the U.S. dollar transaction, so current overnight rates, and we know that IBM is plentiful in the marketplace, so we know that they could go to our competitors and get other clients, IBM of our competitors, so we negotiate a rate of, based off the current Fed effective rate, which might be Fed effective minus 5 basis points or 10 basis points, so in today's environment that might only be 5 basis points. So at that point we've negotiated with the borrower that we're going to pay them a rate of 5 basis points on the cash collateral that they're going to pledge to us for the IBM stock, and let's say that this is a $100 million transaction, and so they're going to give us cash of $100 million plus a 2% margin, which is typical in the industry for loaning U.S. equity securities. So they're going to give us $102 million, and we're going to pay them 5 basis points on that $102 million. And what will happen next is we'll agree to those terms, and then we will simultaneously deliver the IBM and receive the cash collateral from broker-dealer, and at that point we will have $102 million and they will have the client $100 million of IBM. We will then take that $102 million cash and reinvest it in a collateral pool if the client is in a commingled fund with other participants, or if they have their own customized portfolio, we will obviously make an investment only on their behalf in their customized portfolio. And typically what we'll be investing in will be a pool that will earn somewhere between Fed funds flat and Fed funds plus 10 to 15 basis points. And in today's environment, that would probably be about Fed funds plus 5 basis points. So we've lent the security, we're paying 5, 10 basis points below the Fed effective, We're reinvesting at 5 basis points above the Fed effective, so we're going to be, on that transaction, making 15 basis points. And that money then is 15 basis points times the $100 million that we've lent. That is revenue that flows directly to our client and creates value. And then we will ultimately charge a fee to our client for providing them this service that they will pay us typically on a monthly basis. And that's an example of a cash transaction. A non-cash transaction using this exact IBM example would be we negotiate instead to receive cash, to receive equivalent U.S. Treasury valued at $102 million so that we get the appropriate margin against the IBM, and we negotiate a 15 basis point premium fee on that to be assessed again just simply on the amount of the IBM that we have loaned to the broker-dealer. And again, the revenue ends up being the same amount to the client, and we pay that 15 basis points into the client's account, and then we'll assess the fee to the client for that service at the end of the month. An important part of this process is that on a daily basis, we mark to market the security so that that's $2 million of additional collateral that we talked about. If the IBM appreciates, then the next day we're going to be asking for more collateral to maintain the appropriate margin. Or, alternatively, if the asset depreciates, the broker-dealer is going to ask for some of their collateral back because they're now holding a security that's worth less than what it was when they originally borrowed it. And so this mark-to-market process is a very important component to the risk management process associated with the securities lending program. And then, ultimately, when the borrower has no more need for the IBM, they return the security to us. We free up cash in the underlying cash collateral commingled fund or custom fund, and we immediately deliver the cash back to the borrower in the cash transaction with their interest, their rebate interest that we had negotiated to pay them originally. Or if it's a non-cash transaction, we deliver back to them their treasury collateral in the example that I've just provided, and then the transaction ceases to exist.
So
let me clarify a couple of things just for nomenclature as we go forward. Mike, that 5 basis point fee that you referred to that is paid to the borrower in that example, is that often referred to as the rebate?
Yes, in the cash example, yes.
Okay, and when you talked about the yield that would be obtained by the client on the investment of the cash collateral, that is going to vary from client to client depending on the agreement with Northern as to how cash collateral is going to be reinvested. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that this was just an example of how that would work in one situation.
Okay.
Thank
you. Let me just point out for the tape and for you and those of you in Chicago, one of our colleagues, Randall Dodd, joined us while you were answering the previous question. He's also on the research team.
All right, and could you spell his last name, please?
D-O-D-D.
Oh, Dodd, okay.
Hello, Randall.
Hi. Sorry, I was at another meeting. So the short rebate in this example you gave would be approximately 5 basis points?
In today's environment, that's correct, because we have a environment where the Fed funds effective rate is right around 15 basis points today. And I gave an example where we're lending IBM, which is a very plentiful security. And as a consequence, one of the points I want to emphasize about the securities lending program is one of the key determinants in the value that's being generated in a securities lending program is how dear or precious or in short is that IBM. So in this case, IBM's everywhere, so there's a lot of supply, so you know, we're going to have to be negotiating a relatively small decrement from the Fed funds effective with the broker because they could go and borrow at some other place in the market.
So they're going to get the way you normally price the short rebate is you get Fed funds less some fee that is the lending fee on the security or the cost of your services?
Typically, but not always. But typically, on average, and it's important to note when I'm talking about a lot of aspects of the securities lending program, I really am talking about averages, overall sort of profile of the program, and the reason I'm highlighting this is there are going to be some securities transactions in some situations where you could get you might have to pay a rate of interest above the Fed funds rate on the rebate rate. You might have to pay a rate of interest that, depending on what short-term interest rate fluctuations are doing, might be above the return on the collateral pool that you're invested in. Or on the alternative, you might be paying a rebate rate that is significantly below the Fed funds effective rate. And in today's environment, is actually a negative rate of interest, which of course means that someone, the broker dealer, would be actually paying you as opposed to you paying them.
Why would you pay out more than your client is likely to obtain on their investment of that pledged collateral?
Yeah, I don't think Mike is saying that happened, but I think he's saying that in securities lending, these things can happen. And Mike, you want to just talk hypothetically?
Yeah, this is hypothetical, and it's a good question in the context, I think, of people such as yourselves who are thinking about policy and issues. Because the collateral pools typically, again, are going to, as Karen mentioned, are going to have different returns on them dependent on the risk profiles of these collateral pools, but the vast majority of either a custom fund, which I define as a fund that is where only one client is invested in, so it's they're the sole owner of that fund, or a commingled pool, these funds have investment guidelines associated with them and they have average lives that are longer than overnight. And so the example that I'm going to use is going to speak exactly to the construct of the way this business works to really give you a real good example of this. Is that if, for example, we get to a quarter end or a month end or there's some stress in the overnight Fed funds market, the majority of the loans of securities are priced off of that Fed effective. And so a number of those securities are repriced on a daily basis. However, the duration of the cash collateral pool or custom fund, as the case may be, could be 15 days or 30 days. So what you essentially have is a very, very small asset and liability mismatch, which is, again, the design of how these programs work. And as a consequence, you could, if interest rates spike on your funding side or rebate side, if you will, you will need to pay that higher rebate rate in order to keep that security out on loan, or else you'd be forced to potentially liquidate cash collateral investments at, in inappropriate, to generate liquidity, and that process could cost your clients money that they shouldn't be paying, essentially. And that's a mechanical reality of the way the securities lending market works. Of course, it's a mechanical reality of the way any kind of a financial construct, such as a bank, for example, works, where a bank is looking at its asset and liability management activity on an ongoing basis.
Mike, in your example, is that highly situational? In other words, it's going to depend on a multiplicity of factors, including the liquidity in the markets and the prices you can get on collateral, on the sale of collateral.
Yes, and I would also give you another scenario, and that would be I've used the quarter ends and the temporary spikes, but this is a, and we haven't talked at length about the risks associated with securities lending. It is an investment activity, and so therefore it is not a risk-free activity. But this asset and liability mix risk that I mentioned, or the interest rate risk, which is albeit modest, but it exists, where it will become more relevant is when the Federal Reserve, the monetary authorities around the world, start to raise interest rates. And again, what they're doing is they're going to be raising an overnight rate, and of course the management of the cash collateral on the other side is going to have to take into account the possibility that overnight rates could go up by 20 or 50 or 100 basis points, and it's going to have to be structured accordingly. But it's very challenging when managing large pools of liquidity. I would say it's almost impossible to be rolling over huge amounts of money overnight, and you end up getting different risks when you start to manage a portfolio like that, such as concentration risks, for example. So there are going to be times across the entire industry when you can, those would be the reasons why that you know, you might see a rebate rate that is higher than the return on the underlying collateral pool.
What about the specialness of the collateral? Wouldn't that result in the same thing?
I'm sorry, what's the question? I'm
using the opposite thing. I was thinking the negative returns, the negative short rebate would occur if the collateral were special.
Yes.
So you get the opposite effect.
You mean in terms of, can you just give me an example?
Well yeah, so the security borrower is cash lender, and so he may accept a negative interest rate on his cash loan, that is a negative short rebate, if the equity or security were special enough that he was, or she really wanted to short it.
Yes, I think that's true.
Does that happen very often in the, let's say the stocks in the S&P 500?
Not very often in the stocks, the S&P 500, but because of the current interest rate structure, it happens more often than it used to, obviously. If Fed funds was at 6%, my answer to you is it would be extremely infrequent. It's more infrequent today, but it doesn't happen very often on large liquid securities of any type.
So it would happen more on things, the smaller cap stocks out in the NASDAQ or in the over-the-counter equity market?
Yes, like a Russell 2000 stock, for example.
Uh-huh. Okay. So was that an issue much when some of the quant funds were, the so-called quant strategies in the hedge funds, when they were trying to maintain their long-short positions in the market, were they often in stocks that had a, not necessarily a negative interest rate, but below the Fed, had sort of a, the short rebate was less than the Fed funds?
Joel, I don't really have any way to know, and because again, my counterparty is a registered broker dealer, so I'm not privy to, you know, what their specific situations would have been, and they don't disclose to me who their clients are, or you know, specific reasons why they might be borrowing a security at any point in time.
I see.
Okay, that was Randall asking that question, just so you, it's kind of awkward here by phone, but just so you have a sense of who's talking to you at any given time. Can we just get a gross estimate of the sec lending business that you were managing at Northern, say, you know, in at its peak, 2007 or before?
Gross. You know, this is gross because I was in the quant business in 2007.
But probably around the end of 2007, beginning of 2008, I know the business was approached somewhere around, I want to say, $280 billion out on loan. But again, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but that's okay. That's about where I think we were.
Okay. And then you mentioned in terms of reinvesting your clients, let me get the terminology right, cash collateral. Some clients were reinvested into pools and others were reinvested into standalone accounts, I guess, for them individually, right?
Yeah.
Who makes that decision, you or the customer?
The client makes that choice.
And what would an advantage be to having your money in a pool? If there is an advantage.
I think each client has to decide, given their own specific situation, what they feel their advantage would or would not be.
Well, in terms of, describing this to the clients or marketing it, there must be a reason why the money is pooled. So is it, do they get a better return, or are the fees lower? How does that work?
The pools don't determine, a pool fund versus a custom fund does not determine, level of fees or return on cash collateral, because those are all specific to those structures. But what I would say is that a lot of the pool commingled funds that we had managed over the period that I've been familiar with securities lending, had very long track records associated with them, very well established, investment profiles, as a consequence, the clients could, be able to move into a structure that was already existing without preparing their own sets of guidelines and going through that entire process internally on their own. They still have to do their due diligence, and they are the ultimate owners of the assets in any fund that they choose to invest in, whether it's their own fund or whether it's a commingled fund.
Okay.
I also say typically you're going to get typically smaller clients opt for commingled funds because there is an efficiency to managing larger pools of cash that would not exist for managing a smaller pool of cash that might be associated with a smaller type of client. So I think that's a big driver for this.
Okay. These pools have a dollar NAV as an objective?
I would say not. Could you define what an objective is and the question that you're asking?
Well, I guess I've read about some of these cash collateral pools running into some problems because one of their objectives was to maintain a $1 net asset value. Is that something you're familiar with?
What I would say is that what I'm familiar with is that the value of a number of pools, declined, was under pressure as assets depreciated during the financial crisis, and so you saw pressure on the value of the assets in the pools. These pools were historically managed in a way that if you were to mark to market the assets, they would be close to $1. To say that, when you go through the guidelines, we've never set out in the collateral pool guidelines that a $1 NAV is the objective of the fund. And again, this would just be to the best of my recollection, we, in our contracts with our clients, we do have, we do reference the fact that our pools, we try to keep them close to a $1 NAV, but that's not what we've ever laid out as an objective. The way we lay out objectives and constraints, if you will, and guidelines deal with maturities, credit quality, interest rate risk, and all of those aspects of the collateral guidelines are designed to keep the pool of the value of the assets in the collateral pool close to either amortized cost or close to par. And so that's the way, you know, we think about it. We don't think about, you know, breaking the buck or a $1 NAV. But the, and again, the general collateral pool, the collateral pools that, that we manage on behalf of our clients, typically we think about guidelines that would be associated with keeping the value of that collateral pool close to par or close to amortized cost.
Okay. So let's focus now on the events of 2007 and 8, which is really what our commission is tasked with investigating. And I guess from your perspective in terms of the SEC lending business, what were the key events there? Did Bear Stearns, for example, cause significant changes in terms of the type of securities that were lent or the collateral that was pledged or how it was invested? So this would be focusing on the spring of 2008.
Yeah, I think I think the, you know, the watershed event was the Lehman bankruptcy, clearly. I mean, you can almost look at that single event as a before and after event. You know, the world changed after the Lehman event. Before the Lehman event, you could, think about a world that might have been under financial markets that were under stress, markets that were challenged from a liquidity, you know, provision of liquidity point of view. You know, where traditionally broker dealers and market makers who had acted in the, you know, as providers of capital to the financial markets did not, weren't engaged in that activity anymore. But it was really a, I would say prior to Lehman, what you had was a global financial marketplace whose, you know, interworkings, if you will, or functions had become, you know, for lack of a better word, impaired as to traditionally the way intermediaries operated in these marketplaces. And I think that you saw that over time, during the fall of 2007 and into 2008, you saw the reactions of the Federal Reserve and the ECB, because they started to recognize that financing activities globally, between financial institutions were not occurring as they would with regard to either probably rates of interest that were being paid or the size of liquidity that was being provided to counterparties. And I think you saw them to starting to enter into programs where they accepted different types of collateral. These are the central banks where they were willing to accept collateral for longer periods of time than just overnight, because what they were trying to do was make sure that the financial system was able to fund itself adequately during this period of time. And so you didn't have, you had this kind of gradual oncoming dysfunction or lack of liquidity in the global financial system. And but you had nothing, no way, shape, or form did you have anything that really set off the alarm bell like the Lehman crisis, which essentially was the beginning of the meltdown and and you know, the number of other, you know, a couple of other forced sales of major global financial institutions, and Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs becoming bank holding companies. I mean, these were really, this was really an unprecedented activity once Lehman Brothers.
So just focusing pre-Lehman, and I know it's a couple years later, it's hard to sort of sort all this out for all of us, but did you see shifts in terms of the types of securities that were lent? Did people pull back? Did they want more collateral? What were the indicators going on, say, in spring, summer of 2008?
Yeah, I'm just going to, you know, caveat, Mike, the facts are the facts. And, you know, obviously you're asking him to remember back a couple of years. And, you know, you do the best you can, Mike, but keeping in mind that this is something that is objectively, or can be found out through going back and actually looking at records. But
we're trying to get a sense of the market in terms of dealing with, you know, here's someone who dealt with multiple customers on both, or with customers on one side and with counterparties on the other side. We're trying to get a sense of, was the market shifting? Were there noticeable changes just prior to Lehman?
Joel, could I also ask him, answering that, he could also ask if the SEC's rule trying to increase enforcement against naked short selling and requiring prepossession, if that also had an impact prior to Lehman.
Well, you know, with Karen's comments, you know, the thing about the securities lending business is it's an integral part of the financing business of the global financial markets, and so it's in that context that, you know, knowing that securities lending is a financing vehicle, it's in that context that I answer the question about how were we looking at global financing markets, if you will, and that includes, you know, all of the financing activities that major institutions would undertake, and issues revolving around how responsive are central banks being. So, for example, you know, and I already mentioned, I think, that our volumes, I think, peaked out somewhere early 2008, late 2007, and again, I can't recall exactly, but you had, I believe, the S&P 500, I can't remember when it reached its peak, but I think it might have reached its peak during a similar point in the process. So, you know, you had stocks that seemed to still be wanting to go up in an environment where the financial engine of the global markets was clearly experiencing stress based on the fact that you had the Federal Reserve and the ECB engaged in trying to engage in activities that provided more liquidity to the marketplace. So you had some conflicting signals, you know, going on. And I think that if I could, from my point of view, just reference the mindset of the market in late 2007, early 2008, I think it was looking at forceful and somewhat unprecedented intervention by monetary authorities as a positive signal that monetary authorities would ensure that liquidity remained adequate in the marketplace. And clearly that was their intention. And so if I looked at the securities lending activity that we were engaged in and looked at financing rates and those types of specific indicators, I think they reacted in the way the overall market reacted to the fact that you had the monetary authorities engaged in trying to make sure the market knew that they were going to be lenders of last resort. They were going to be engaged in providing liquidity. And I would characterize then that you saw a fairly normal operating environment with regard to the provisioning of liquidity as it regards the lending of securities, for example. And, of course, we know Bear Stearns was sold to forced sell to J.P. Morgan, I guess, beginning of April, late March. And as that event unfolded, Again, I would characterize the market as somewhat, and the market being both the equity markets and the financing markets, but the equity market breathed a little sigh of relief in there, and the S&P actually rallied. And again, the mindset of the marketplace was, okay, you know, the Fed has engineered this. We don't see any kind of, meltdown, to use a somewhat emotional, inflammatory word, of the financial marketplace, that the monetary authorities have these events and these activities well in hand. And I think that that was, from my point of view, and that's not to say there wasn't a heightened sense of concern with regard to, you know, market participants, with regard to illiquidity in the marketplace, but what we were looking at, and I think what everybody was looking at, was how are the monetary authorities addressing clearly what they see are issues in the marketplace. And so that, to me, was the mindset of the market during that period of time, that we're going to get through this with, because we've got monetary authorities who have this, who are on top of the issue that they're looking at here.
So in terms of the nature of your business during that period, say pre-bear and then post-bear up until Lehman, did it change significantly? Was the demand for securities, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, certain securities are in demand at some periods of time and others less so. Were there changes that you identified during that period of time, pre-Lehman?
So you're talking about like pre and post bear or pre and post Lehman?
Well, let's say during the period that bear was rescued and then on through the summer of 2008 up to Lehman, did the nature of the business change in any way?
Okay, and one of your examples of that is like demand for securities to be loaned. Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be evasive here, but I don't have a specific answer for you, and I'll just, you know, answer it generally. You have ebbs and flows in demand for different securities over different periods of time, I would expect, and again, I don't have specific knowledge, or specific information, but I would think during this period of time of heightened concern that U.S. Treasuries obviously became very in high demand, because there was a, you know, the marketplace wanted, there was a premium on liquidity, the counterparties in the marketplace wanted to hold instruments that had, from their point of view, a high degree of safety associated with them. And I don't have the specifics about, you know, how much more attractive those treasuries were, but I do believe, to the best of my knowledge, that they were more attractive. And that would be, I would say, a prime example of where you saw the demand of a specific class of securities, in this case, U.S. Treasury securities, respond to a an overall concern in the global financial system.
Michael, I had a related question. Historically, the securities lending market, in comparison to the repo, always had negative haircuts, and that you've got to over collateralize the security loan. And the repo market, you take a haircut off the security. I heard that during the crisis, the equity market started moving toward the same operation, where instead of putting 102% of collateral up to borrow the equity, you were putting up 98 or 95%. Did you observe that?
No. I mean, we have, if I understand this correctly, you're talking about when we loan that $100 million of IBM, in the example I gave earlier, and we have to take the 2%, so we take $102 million, so that $2 million is our margin collateral, those practices were unchanged in terms of our the way we manage our exposure to these broker-dealers. And, you know, I would add, obviously, we had a heightened degree of vigilance, as was appropriate, given some of the concerns in the marketplace. So, you know, if anything, we were very focused on ensuring that we had adequate margin, that we were marking to market appropriately, that you know, all of the aspects of our program were being, were operating as they were designed to operate.
What about,
no, I did not see anything like what you're describing.
About it taking a haircut as opposed to an additional margin. Did you observe, what kind of problems did you observe around settlement failures?
You know, I don't have any specific knowledge on that either, I'm sorry to say, but, you know, we did not see, to the best of my knowledge, any unusual fail activity during, you know, the period of time up until, let's say, the Lehman crisis. And that's not to say we saw anything unusual afterwards, but, you know, other than a Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, which would be an unprecedented situation, obviously. But we did not see anything that was dysfunctional, if you will, with regard to the mark-to-market mechanisms, with regard to the rates of failures among securities. You know, we just... We didn't see anything appreciably different than what our normal course of business experience had been.
Is that right? Huh. Because I've gotten SEC data that showed that there were 2 billion shares failing a day at settlement, which was about anywhere between a quarter and a 10% of the daily trading volume.
Now, if that issue was... in what period of time was that?
Off the top of my head, I can't tell you. I thought it was in the summer of 2008, and that was, I think, one of the things the SEC was looking at when they were trying to enforce the prepossession rule to prohibit naked short selling, which they thought was giving rise to some of these settlement failures.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it may be, and it's the reason I'm asking the question, because, you know, our clients, outside of the securities lending business, but our custody clients who have hired investment managers that, you know, I mean, we're custodying somewhere around $3.5 or $4 trillion worth of assets, so the investment managers that are the underlying investment managers for our clients are buying and selling securities every day, and I'm not aware that on the client side of our business experienced an increased failure rate like that. And so one of the questions might be, was that a failure rate that existed between the borrowers and their clients? You know, it's a real hard sort of statistic to address without, you know, a broader context around it. But from our perspective as a custodian and a securities lender who, you know, looked at the settlement process for our clients outside of securities lending and within securities lending, we, you know, we didn't see, certainly, you know, and I don't know the context of what 2 million or 2 billion would be relative to normal SEC statistics, but, you know, to the best of my knowledge, we did not see any kind of a substantial failure rate among our client portfolios or, you know, the return of the securities and with regard to our lending portfolio.
If there
so
were...
What you're saying, Mike, is that fail in the context of securities lending would be the borrower not returning the security at the end of the loan.
On a timely manner.
Which is a big, probably a big subset of your $2 billion number. I'm sorry, probably a small subset of your $2 billion number.
No, I think that's... I think that's why they thought it was occurring, and that people were doing securities lending, and instead of returning the securities in a timely manner, they were hanging on to it and not delivering it on time for the third day settlement. And that's because they hadn't obtained prepossession and were, for whatever reason, were finding it cheaper to fail on the settlement. And there was a couple of academic papers written on it. One was, to fail is an option. And they were talking about the economic advantages of failing compared to the cost of prepossession. And so I've been...
Yeah, there are, you know, well, part of this is, and it's something that I think it's important to understand how a securities lending agent such as the Northern Trust would operate if when we see a increased failure rate. You know, we have, with any broker dealer, I mean, we have processes where, you know, the broker dealer is contractually obligated to return the security to us when we recall that security. And the contracts that we have with regard to our broker dealers are, you know, fairly expansive in the sense that we have remedies that if, you know, we want the markets to operate normally, and we understand from time to time that broker dealers are going to fail to deliver securities for reasons outside of their control. But we watch the fails very closely because we need to, we are obligated on behalf of our clients to deliver those securities wherever they've delivered them. So when a fail happens, we are on the phone with the broker dealer saying, you must return this security to us, and we will take the necessary steps to ensure that that security, one way or the other, comes back into our client's portfolio. So, you know, as agent, my only point here is, as lending agent, our incentive, if you will, our contractual, the contractual obligation that the borrower has to us is very clear, that they must return that security, or else they are, you know, it's attorneys here, but they're in breach of their contract and their remedies there. And on the other side, you're obligated to make delivery of that security on behalf of our client. And so we're going to do everything that we have reasonably at our disposal to create a situation where that happens, because that's our role in this process. It's not to allow fails to continue to propagate in the marketplace. So we're out there saying, deliver this security to me, or else I'm going to go out and buy the security into the open market. And the interesting thing is that that does become very expensive for someone who's failing to deliver to you.
That's right. So are you, can you force buy-in at the DTC, or are you not a clearing member that can do that?
Well, I can't answer that question specifically because it's more technical than I'm aware. But my provisions in the contract that I have with my borrower, I do that. I can do that, and I have done that.
And you didn't notice an increase in that activity during 2008?
You know, again, I don't have the specifics in front of me, but and I would have expected that, you know, given the disruptions in the markets, you might have seen more fails than typical, but I am not aware of anything that we would deem to be an outsized failure. And if there were, we would have, I believe we would have been very engaged and aware of that. And our clients, most importantly, your clients, the very transparent action that happens here when a fail occurs is that when you're lending securities, part of the discussion with the client and part of the attractiveness to a securities lending program, and this is something you asked earlier, is that it should not interfere with the underlying management of the investment portfolio. And when you have a failed security, what happens is if there's an underlying investment manager, let's just say BlackRock, and BlackRock's the investment manager for your client, a teacher's pension plan. BlackRock will call that teacher's pension plan and call Northern Trust Company and say, I sold my security, and why am I failing to deliver my security, Northern Trust Company? And that's something that Northern Trust Company, on behalf of our client, doesn't want to see happen. And that's not how, you know, we manage a securities lending program. And it's for those reasons that, you know, we're very focused on fails.
Okay. In terms of having, would it be an approved list for broker-dealers with whom you're going to do business? Is that how it's set up?
Yes, and limit as well.
I'm sorry?
Yes, and limits as well.
Limits, okay. So with Bear Stearns, were there any issues in terms of having client exposure to them?
What do you mean by that?
When Bear Stearns was having problems in late March, April, did you still have Bear Stearns on your approved list?
Yes, and clearly we were focused on Bear Stearns, we were focused on the margin that we were receiving from Bear Stearns, and we were focused on the types and amounts of transactions that we had out with Bear Stearns and the level of activity that we had with Bear Stearns. So, in all of the environments, part of our responsibility is to ensure that adequate margin is maintained in the environment that we're in, that we are monitoring very closely the broker-dealer's activity. But the behavior of Bear Stearns, they were able to fulfill their contractual obligations with regard to their activity with us. That's not to say they might not have had a sale that was outstanding or something like that. Again, something that happens as a matter of course in modest amounts, as I've just gone through and discussed. But that'd be my answer to our experience with Bear Stearns during that period of time.
So when it was acquired by J.P. Morgan, it was seamless from your perspective?
Yes.
Okay, and then what about Lehman? How did that play out?
Did clients get their securities back in Lehman?
That would be one way it played out, and that absolutely clients did receive their securities. None of our clients suffered a loss with regard to the lending of their securities to Lehman Brothers. That means that all securities that we had loaned to Lehman on behalf of our clients were either returned to their account, and in the case of a very, very, very small percentage of perhaps and I don't have the specific information here, but I want to give myself a caveat, if you will, that says there might have been a very, very small dollar amount, if you will, of securities that were either not liquid or not traded in the marketplace that we compensated our clients for. And again, that would be consistent with the lending contracts that we had with our clients. So in effect, there was no loss to our clients. And so what we did in that situation is the collateral that we had from Lehman Brothers, both cash and non-cash, we utilized to go out and purchase those securities in the marketplace and place them back into our clients' account. By and large, we were able to do that very effectively within a very short period of time. I don't have the exact stats, but it would be something like within 5 days, we were able to get 90% of our clients' securities back into their portfolios in what was a most difficult, and that's putting it mildly, unprecedented financial meltdown. So we felt, and I think our clients generally felt, that the process worked as designed, and our clients were pleased that they suffered no losses as a result of lending their securities specifically.
So prior in the weeks leading up to Lehman's failure, were the terms changed at all by Northern in the SEC lending program in terms of requiring more collateral or in reducing exposure overall? How did you handle that internally?
Well, there was a...
Who asked that question? I'm sorry.
This is Joel.
Okay, hi, Joel. Thanks.
Joel, there was a lot of focus on Lehman Brothers in the period leading up to their bankruptcy, the weeks, let's call it. And and again, I wasn't directly involved, but I was aware that we asked for more margin associated with Lehman Brothers transactions because we were looking at the stress that Lehman Brothers was specifically under. We had no indications that you know, there would be a bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, but we certainly felt that it was prudent to ask for more margin against the securities loans. We didn't see what I would characterize any kind of a real abnormal behavior from them. And again, this is against the backdrop of everything that you're seeing in the press, everything that you were seeing in the marketplace that was occurring. So we did think it was the prudent thing to do to ask for more margin. I know that it was discussed, and I'm not sure to the extent that, you know, how we changed our limits, but I believe our limits were adjusted during that period of time. I can't really address whether we actually went out and recalled securities back from Lehman Brothers during this period of time. We were certainly cognizant of the fragility of the financial markets and not wanting to take an action that would precipitate, some larger crisis. On the other hand, we looked at our margins and we knew that it would be prudent to adjust those margins to recognize that the fragility of the financial system and Lehman Brothers in particular.
And then when Lehman went bankrupt on Sunday night or Monday morning, you had said earlier that sort of changed, I don't have the quote here, but, you know, that changed everything, probably overstated. So what happened to the, as you recall it, in terms of Northern's relationship with Lehman, with other parties in the marketplace, with your customers? Can you just play out that week for us?
Yes, I'll try to. What I would say is that, you know, prior to that week, prior to the bankruptcy on Sunday night, we took some actions internally to prepare for potential bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. And by that, we looked at very specifically at the list of securities that we had out on loan. We prepared a process to go out and liquidate the collateral to buy in the securities in the event that Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. And so that was the week leading up to the weekend of the Lehman bankruptcy. And then when Lehman, we took a number of actions like that, specifically looking at the Lehman Brothers exposure, making sure that we were prepared to go out and buy our clients' securities in if that became necessary. And then when Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy on Sunday, they didn't. We decided we didn't go out and buy securities immediately on Sunday evening in the Asian markets because, just like in the situation Baring Brothers when they went bankrupt, which was a much smaller situation, it was their UK subsidiary, I believe, that first said that we got the term that under administration, I believe, is what they say. I can't recall what they say, but what happened was, of course, they closed down Lehman London immediately, but the U.S. broker-dealer was allowed to operate. This created some, confusion about what was the legal status of Lehman Brothers, the corporation. We began immediately on Monday morning executing on our plan to buy in the securities of LBIE, which was Lehman Brothers International. And we continued to transact business with Lehman New York. We continued to transact business with Lehman New York, and because they were returning securities to us, and so Lehman New York was trying to unwind themselves in a somewhat orderly fashion, which of course was the lowest cost alternative to get our client security back in, and lowest risk alternative to get our client security back into the portfolio. So we went out and executed buy-ins for the securities that we had on loan to Lehman International. We continued to work off the exposures, working with Lehman New York for the securities that they were returning to us. And then I don't recall exactly what day Lehman, New York ceased to exist. It was either Wednesday or Thursday that week, or Friday possibly.
I think it was Friday.
Friday. And so once that date was hit, we then had the remaining exposure that we had to Lehman, New York on behalf of our clients. We went out and began to execute buy-ins of those securities at that point in time. And, you know, throughout that week, obviously it was a, I think that was when you had the reserve fund maybe went, stopped functioning. You had, I think over the that following weekend might have been the Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley announcement. I can't remember when Merrill Lynch got consumed.
The weekend of the bankruptcy, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was basically in financial system, you had all of these, I'll call them events occurring, and the actions that we were taking on behalf of our clients with regard to Lehman Brothers, against the backdrop of what was happening, the fact that we were able to go out and repurchase these securities in an efficient and, you know, measured manner, I consider it to be one of the success stories of how securities lending operated as was designed during, I think, what would be the most stressful scenario you could ever imagine for financial markets.
Did you have the same sort of contingency plans for Merrill or Morgan or Goldman even as you had for Lehman?
Essentially, the same sort is...
Hold on 1 second?
Yes. So here's what I'll say, and I'll go back to, you know, our contractual relationship with our borrowers. Really, you know, and I answered it when you asked me earlier about, you know, my ability to buy in via DTC and whether or not I was a member, and I said, you know, I really can't tell you specifically, but our relationship with our borrowers is governed by that contract, and that contract is what gives us as agent the ability to protect our clients in events where the broker-dealers don't follow their contractual obligations. So that's really where we derive our remedies or have our remedies explicitly laid out. And with regard to specifically, and so everything else flows from that contract. And, you know, in different time periods, it's just a question of, and I don't want to overly simplify it because we were in most difficult times, but it's the question of how close are you to implementing some of those remedies that are envisioned in the contract? And clearly during the period of time that you're referencing with all the uncertainty, we had very much a heightened focus and heightened preparedness, if you will, to act on the contractual ability that we would have been provided in the event that we, you know, had another borrower bankruptcy or impairment. Or for some reason the borrower wasn't able to act in accordance with the contractual obligation. So, you know, we were being as prudent as possible in terms of managing the environment and being prepared to act in accordance with our contract.
I mean, Mike, are you basically saying that, you know, pursuant to these contracts, Northern Trust knows what various borrowers have out on loan, knows how to cover and do buy-ins and so on and so forth, and, you know, well in advance of any specific crisis, has the wherewithal to act quickly, you know, in that circumstance.
Yes.
So you had mentioned you had contingency plans in the event Lehman were to go bankrupt, and my question was, did you have similar plans for Merrill Lynch?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by contingency plan. I mean, that someone actually sat down and wrote up a plan specifically for Lehman versus what I think Mike is saying is that we know our rights, Northern knows its rights, and has the ability to monitor the situation and get ready.
Look, I think that's right. I mean, I would say, I don't want it to sound too, but we followed similar processes for other broker-dealers post the Lehman crisis that we did for Lehman Brothers. We, you know, in these processes, the important thing to understand is they stem from our borrower contract. And certainly our obligation to our clients, you know, we have to be ready to fulfill our obligation to our clients, and that is to put the securities back into their account. So we're going to take preparations that would put us in that position. And I can tell you that we did have similar preparations for other counterparties that we had lent securities to. That's the way I would characterize that. And it was, you know, in the level of the preparedness and the degree and extent and all those things, you know, are clearly contingent on the stress, but, you know, we are in a stressful period, so our awareness and our heightened concern, you know, we were preparing for, you know, we were looking at different scenarios, and we were trying to be prepared for those scenarios. And we prepared, at least in some instances. I can't speak to Merrill Lynch specifically, where we were looking at securities that we had out on loan and making sure that we had, you know, reconciled lists. There are a number of issues that, quite frankly, are more, you know, they are process-related issues that if we got into a situation like a Lehman situation, that we would be prepared to act accordingly.
Were there any brokers that you simply cut off and declined to do further business with and sought to obtain the lent securities back from?
Here's the way I would answer that. Not to the best of my knowledge, you know, because you said simply cut off or, you know, sought to, you know, call back all the securities. So not to the best of my knowledge, and I think that's an accurate statement that we didn't do that. Again, to the best of my knowledge. What I will say, though, is we did manage our credit relationships with these counterparties during this period of time, and we were very cognizant of the fact that other counterparties were under stress, and so we managed the risks accordingly in that environment. And again, that's the type of thing that you would do in any environment, but again, this was a very heightened risk environment. We've always managed our limits with our broker dealers, but your question, I think, specifically goes to, did you completely cut somebody off? Did you take substantial action that would have, you know, basically stopped, you know, ended your relationship and bought in another broker dealer, such as, you know, what occurred with the bankruptcy of Lehman? And my answer would be not to the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay. And really what I'm trying to determine here is, were there some, maybe a regional firm or a smaller firm than Merrill, Lehman, Goldman, Morgan, that you felt was running into problems and you felt on behalf of your customers as agent that it would be prudent for you to remove the risk from the equation?
Well, the answer is, you know, we typically, I think among the firms that we deal with, we don't we may have one or two, and I can't even recall, to tell you the truth, if we have any kind of a sizable regional firm that we deal with. I mean, you know, we deal with primarily the largest broker-dealers, and so my answer would be, in that context, absolutely no, we didn't. You know, we were most focused on the largest broker-dealers in the marketplace.
Okay. And as the events then played out in the week following the Lehman bankruptcy, again, you described it as, you know, a major deal changer, essentially. What else did you have to do to, you know, as agent, as you said, for your customers, what else did you have to do to protect them?
Well, immediately upon the Lehman bankruptcy, obviously that telegraphed to everyone that the world has changed, but that there was a major event. So the risk, in particular, in
commingled funds that, and this is, I want to make sure that you understand we're not talking about the bank here. We're talking about commingled funds that we manage on behalf of our clients. The risk that those clients would come in and say, you know, pull me out of securities lending immediately. My contract says I can give you 3 days notice and I can be out of securities lending for U.S. equities, for example. What we did was to protect and safeguard all of our clients was we prevented clients from exiting completely the securities lending program because that would, in cash, I might add. So to say, give me my cash, I want to exit. Our clients could exit securities lending by taking the securities that they held in those commingled funds in kind. But the reason for providing that safeguard was quite simply that if some clients were permitted to get out and then other clients remained and the fund, the commingled fund, ultimately didn't have enough liquidity, that those clients that remained would be saddled with the issues that they would face because they had illiquid investments. And so we took that action in order to protect and safeguard all of our clients.
What were the illiquid securities that caused concern?
Well, I'll come back to that in one second.
Okay.
Finish on the other part of this, though, is that clients needed to continue to manage their pension programs. They needed to pay benefits. They needed to raise cash for various situations. And so we allowed our clients to continue to to transact business in ordinary course. So if they needed to sell a security, they could sell a security that we had on loan, and we'd recall it, and we'd deliver it to whomever they had sold it to. The point here is this is a fairly narrow safeguard, but an important one is that we would not let them remove themselves completely from the securities lending program in cash. Because that's where it would have created, in a commingled fund, a risk for all the clients in that fund. So they were able to, if they wanted to exit securities lending, they would need to take the underlying securities in the cash collateral portfolio with them, so they could exit in that manner. And of course, that would require them to come up with potentially cash to fund those positions. But also, we knew that this, we did not want any hardship to put on our clients in terms of their underlying portfolio management activities, so they were able to conduct that business as usual to the best of my knowledge. And we had a committee that had been established for a number of years to oversee collateral issues called our Securities Lending Collateral Committee. So again, that was a well-established process. It certainly took on a new level of importance throughout and after the crisis of Lehman Brothers hit, and that was the primary framework that we utilized to administer the safeguards on behalf of all of our clients. So again, I think the question of how the process worked, it worked well in terms of here's what our contracts are with our clients. Here are the processes that we had established within Northern Trust Company, and here in a marketplace that had a bankruptcy event and a global financial illiquidity, if you will, these were the processes that we had established and that we executed on. With regard to your other question, it was about cash. Gave us problems. Could you just ask that question again?
Right. In terms of your concern that some of these cash collateral pools may have liquidity issues and you put restrictions on withdrawals from them, what were the types of securities that you felt were less liquid post-Lehman than pre-Lehman?
Could I just make a comment at this point? We're at about an hour and 40 minutes. How much longer are you guys planning to go?
A couple questions.
Probably
Because I was on the understanding it would be about 2 hours.
Yeah, definitely we will be done before noon Eastern time. So probably okay. 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, because I was going to suggest a bathroom break at this point, but if we're 10 minutes away, let's just finish up. Do people agree with that?
I'm fine with that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, you're right. All right. Okay, so I think the pending question is, what is the need to have these safeguards around total exit in cash and securities lending? Why was there a need to do that?
And I think specifically it's a question to ask about what types of securities were liquid or not liquid. And I think that this is such a difficult question to answer because the market overall was impaired. So if you didn't have an asset that was maturing on an overnight basis, you could regardless of whether it was a commercial paper or whether it was a CD or whether it was a credit card security that was AAA rated, any security that did not have an overnight maturity had some type of stress associated with it. There was some type of a discount, if you will, if you tried to go out and liquidate that asset in the marketplace. And you saw, particularly with regard to financial institutions, any kind of assets associated with financial institutions, during this period of time were extremely illiquid, unless they were overnight maturities. So any global bank, any major financial firm, you had, your asset-backed securities. And, essentially what had happened in this period of time is because the global financial system itself was impaired. The global financial system, which is ultimately designed to provide the secondary market and liquidity for fixed income instruments of all types, but particularly with regard to the highly rated types of securities that we owned, these intermediaries ceased to function in a normal manner. Clearly, they were focused on their own survival, I would say. And so, it's a question that, it's a question that I know that a lot of us try to ask ourselves and focus in on. I think, if I assign intent, is this security appropriate or is that security appropriate? Well, we were always buying, very highly rated securities, AAA, AA, liquid types of securities that, could be sold in the marketplace in a normal, and I'm going to use the word normal at some risk here, operating environment. And what I'm defining abnormal is where you have all the major global financial institutions at risk of being either acquired or potentially supported by central banks. And clearly those institutions were focused on their survivability, not focused on providing liquid secondary markets for instruments that they had historically provided that role in the global financial system for. So it's a very difficult question to say, how do you define illiquidity because of the type of security you're holding, or do you define illiquidity because of the financial environment that we are experiencing? And I very much am of the opinion that the financial environment that we are experiencing drove the illiquidity and therefore, the pricing of any of the securities that we would have seen in the portfolio as that statement covers the vast majority of the high quality assets that we held in our funds. And that would be my, comment. I mean, we experienced situations that you had 2 week CDs of AA rated financial institutions that you could not sell during this period of time. You had AAA rated corporations that we held commercial paper in that you could not sell during this period of time at a reasonable price, which means you might be seeing discounts of
15% to 20% off of face. And these discounts, from our point of view, were related to the fact that there was a severe disruption in orderly financial markets in this period of time.
Okay.
That was our experience.
Right. So what you're saying is that example you gave of the discount, that was a liquidity discount, not a credit discount.
That's been our experience with the vast majority of the assets in our portfolios.
Okay. At a certain point in time, Northern provided support to some of these cash collateral pools. Is that correct?
No. We gave money to our clients directly. So we did not provide support to our securities lending cash collateral pools. And the reason we did that was because Northern's a client-focused organization, and we knew that our clients were experiencing duress as a result of the financial environment, and we chose to voluntarily provide those cash payments directly to our clients in recognition of the fact and as a symbol of our alignment with their interests. So we did not, it's important to understand, we did not provide support to these cash collateral pools. And it was the right decision, we think, for our clients and ultimately for our shareholders, and that's the reason. We look at our business that we're operated in, we're around since 1889, and we know that our clients are really what allows us to exist, and in a crisis situation, how you behave, the kind of signals you send to your clients, we voluntarily took the step to give them a cash contribution directly to the client.
So I'm not quite clear then. If the client gets cash, then does Northern in some way take their pro rata share of the securities in the pool?
No, this was all outside of the pool. The clients, we just simply provided them cash into whatever account they asked us to put that cash into. And if there were any kind of losses in the pool, that was the client's responsibility ultimately.
And is that defined for in the securities lending authorization agreements that the clients earned, Mike?
Yeah, the client is they are liable for the cash collateral pools.
Then I'm still missing something here. If the client has $50 million in a cash collateral pool, I'm making this up, and you give them $5 million, do they still have a $50 million interest in the pool?
Yes. Now, if their pool suffers losses, they're responsible for, they are obligated to return that cash collateral to the borrower, from whom they borrowed the cash from and lent the security to. And if they don't do that, they're in breach of their contract with the borrower because, again, we're lending as agent to them. So we're lending as agent on the lender's behalf. And so it's the client's obligation to ensure that cash is returned to the borrower, or else the borrower can take their security and liquidate it if they don't do that.
So the cash was to assist, am I correct? It was to assist the lenders that wanted to take back their securities to make the borrower whole. Is that correct? I guess I'm not clear what the cash was for.
I think during this period of time, there were some assets that had impairment across some of these funds, but ultimately we wanted to make a cash payment to our clients to recognize that they were experiencing some pain in this process. And we did that, and we didn't have any agreement that said, if you lose this much, we will pay you this much, or anything of that nature. We simply knew that you know, this was going to be a difficult time, and we wanted to do the right thing, which was to signal to our clients that we stand with them in a difficult period of time. And just to paraphrase it, I think, you know, that would be the type of communication that we made, we being the CFO and others associated with Northern Trust Company, made to the broader marketplace with regard to our decision to contribute money directly to our clients.
So I think Mike is basically illustrating that under the agreements with the clients are responsible for any principal losses, and they remained responsible for that. Northern did not undertake to pay for realized principal losses. But wholly outside of that process, Northern made a voluntary contribution to individual client accounts.
And you know, to put it into some context, if you remember at this point in time, when we did this in the fall and the winter, if you will, it was really the fall of 2008, it's hard for all of us to remember exactly what a difficult time that was, and I know your committee and group is revisiting all of that, but it was an unprecedented, the most difficult time one could imagine in a normal financial structure. And as a consequence, those were
dark days. And so when you think about the payment that we made to our clients, that was, I think, and I'm going to speak on behalf of our clients, and it's pure speculation on my part, but I think clients view that as a very small gesture that we were in this with our clients to the extent that we were, you know, providing them some emotional, moral, and monetary, support through this most difficult period in total, you know, their total experience. Because if you just step away from securities lending, what they were experiencing in their underlying investment portfolios, what they were experiencing in, you know, other investments they might have been invested in, this was I don't want to understate, you know, what we did, because it was an important, for us, we thought it was an important signal to our clients, but it in no way, shape, or form alleviated them at that point for the type of exposure that they had to the cash collateral pools and to the financial markets more broadly. You know, those two just didn't, in terms of size, did not equate to one another at that point in time. And I think it's important, I hope I'm emphasizing an appropriate point here, because for that number, to give the client a contribution directly to them to acknowledge the importance of that client to our organization, did not alleviate them of their concerns around the greater financial peril that existed at that time. So, you know, they didn't in any way, I think, equate this with, well, you're going to take care of any losses I may have in the future or losses I may have currently, because the number that we provided just simply didn't line up with the exposure that they had at that point in time, which was significant. And so I just wanted to expand on that point for purposes of clarity, because I do think it's an accurate and relevant point here for how we think about Northern's actions to, you know, both protect, safeguard, and align ourselves with our clients during that time.
So you, unlike some of your competitors, you did not purchase some of these illiquid assets out of these cash collateral pools?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay. Steve?
Did you have any interactions? How do regulators affect you in any way? Regulators of securities markets. Do you have any interactions with them in the securities lending area?
You mean the SEC?
Yeah.
Could you hold on one second?
Yes.
You know, these are unregistered funds, so I'm not sure I understand the question. These are not money market funds.
No, I just thought perhaps, nevertheless, I thought there might be some reactions. That's the only question that I have for now. That's the only thing.
Okay.
Unless you wanted to add something to that.
No, that's okay.
All right, well, we've taken up close to all of the allotted time. I have lots more questions to ask, but we have a report to write and you have a business to run, so we really appreciate your insights here. And what we'll do, Karen, is send you an email just describing what the FCIC's policy is with regard to the recording.
Okay, could you hold on 1 second? Okay, thank you very much. I hope you found the process to be one in which Northern was cooperative. I think Mike really went out of the way to, you know, give you descriptive answers and to help you out, and I hope you interpreted the same way I did. And it was and remains our intention to be cooperative. So, you know, if there's anything else you need from us, let us know.
Yeah, the only thing we'd do is give him a chance to add anything he wanted to add that maybe we didn't cover.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. I think we touched on all the mechanics and importantly, the operation of security funding during, before, during, and after, if you will. So hopefully I provided good context for you with regard to some of these issues that you're looking at.
Well, it's been very helpful, and we appreciate all your time. So thanks very much. All right.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.